Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
And I'm Ivan Semenek in Boston.
And this is SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
This week on the July 21st edition of SciPod, Going, Going, Gone. Astronomers find a group of stars that are leaving the Milky Way at what seems like impossibly high speed, and it turns out they have a deep, dark secret.
Deja vu all over again. And again. How to recreate that old familiar feeling in the lab, and use it to explore the inner workings of memory.
Wasting away. Scientists discover that radiation makes bones disappear. Now the question is how to get astronauts to Mars without turning them into jellyfish.
And in praise of alchemy, we drop in on a conference that celebrates all those who once tried to turn lead into gold. In the process, it seems they were also turning ancient wisdom into modern science. SciPod. It's not just a podcast. It's elementary. You might think that meeting a giant black hole would be the end of the road for a star. But sometimes it's just the beginning of a new life on the fast track. That's the conclusion of astronomers who've just made a rather startling and unexpected find. Literally the fastest moving stars in the Milky Way. And as Ivan discovered, these stars could tell us a great deal about our galaxy. Provided we can keep up with them.
Astronomer Warren Brown is taking me stargazing. But to understand what's really interesting about the stars he studies, I need to see them on a computer plot rather than through a telescope.
Okay, so here's one plot that's of interest, I think.
The stars we're looking at are in the distant outer reaches of our Milky Way galaxy, a sparse cosmic wilderness called the Galactic Halo. In images of the night sky, these remote stars look no different than the many, many nearer stars that are in the foreground. It's when the light of one of these halo stars is spread out into a spectrum that its true identity is revealed.
The plot you see here on the screen is a map of the sky, and in this case in galactic coordinates, where you see galactic latitude and longitude. And so the colors of these dots represent the velocities of the stars, where in this case the blue stars, the wavelengths blue shifted, that is, they're moving towards us, and the red stars are ones that are moving away from us.
This relationship between color, direction, and speed is also known as the Doppler shift, and it's the standard tool in astronomy for figuring out which way things are moving and how fast. Since halo stars move differently from stars in the rest of the galaxy, this stellar speedometer offers a good way to spot them. But then, quite by chance, Brown ran into a star that was really unusual. Or perhaps we should say, it ran into him.
And when we measured its spectrum, it didn't look anything any different from the other stars that we were observing in terms of how a spectrum looked, but the velocity that the spectrum told us it had, that velocity was over 1.5 million miles per hour, which is an absurd velocity for a star in the Milky Way. And not only that, but given the faintness of the star, I mean, it's a very distant star. A star that distant, traveling that fast, is moving many times the velocity you need to escape the gravitational pull of the Milky Way forever. So this star is never coming back.
And just like that, Brown found himself looking at the fastest known star in the Milky Way galaxy, faster by such a large margin that he and his colleagues at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics had to ask why. But the closer they looked, the stranger things seemed. For example, even though the stars of the galactic halo are uniformly quite old, this star was young, younger in fact than our own sun. Clearly, it came from well within the Milky Way, where younger stars are common. But why was it racing out of the galaxy like a steroid-powered flyball?
And so at first we didn't know what to make of that. It's one of those things where we observed it, and it was a surprise. And then we started investigating, so what could this be? And the explanation wasn't obvious to us. And that's where it got interesting for us. And so it turns out that half the stars in the sky are systems containing a pair of stars, or sometimes more. And so it's possible for pairs of stars to interact with one another like in a cluster of stars. We have many stars all close together. And now and then these stars can be tossed out when, you know, out of the cluster. But those sort of, you know, so-called runaway stars move at much lower velocities and are generally seen pretty near the sun. So that sort of explanation didn't make any sense.
Another explanation they considered was that this star didn't come from the Milky Way at all. But that also made no sense, because such a star would have very different properties. It was at this point that Brown came across a remarkable idea.
And then we found, or I found this paper that was written by a theorist back in 1988, a Nature paper by Jack Hills. And he predicted that if you have a pair of stars that happens to get too close to a supermassive black hole, well, it's possible for the black hole to capture one star, and then the other star leaves with the entire energy of the pair, and so it is ejected with this incredible velocity. And suddenly, and that's kind of, that was my aha moment. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is a prediction of what we've observed.
Astronomers already have good reason to suspect that a giant black hole, millions of times more massive than our sun, is lurking at the very center of the Milky Way. It's also a place that's densely packed with young stars, so it's easy to imagine that a close pair of stars could be caught up in the black hole's gravitational trap, with one star staying locked to the black hole forever, and the other getting kicked out of the system at incredibly high speed. According to Brown, if you could hitch a ride on such a star, it would make for an incredible journey.
So if you start from the moment that the star was flying around the supermassive black hole, at that moment it was probably traveling a few percent of the speed of light. So it was seeing things move by very quickly. And the galactic center is such a crowded region, you would see the sky just covered with stars, you know, as bright as the moon perhaps, all over the place. But very quickly, you would see that disappear, the number of stars would get fewer and fewer. And then after a few tens of millions of years, you're pretty much out of the galaxy completely. You're just traveling through sort of the really empty outer regions of the halo. And as the further the star goes, the blacker space gets, and to the point where the star will be lost in the blackness of space.
After that first chance discovery last year, Brown and his colleagues have started to search for similar cases of what they call hypervelocity stars, and they found four more of them. Clearly, the giant black hole at the center of our galaxy has been doing a lot of batting practice. For Brown, this is particularly exciting news. The story has gone from solving a scientific mystery to using the results as a way of probing the history and dynamics of the very center of our galaxy.
Because these stars originate from an encounter with a black hole, the travel times of these stars that we infer from their current positions tells us about the history of stars interacting with the massive black hole. And that gives us actually a way of measuring the history of what stars have been doing down the galactic center for the past 100 million years, which is kind of amazing.
Another exciting prospect is that hypervelocity stars can be used to investigate the invisible dark matter that's believed to dominate the galactic halo. But to achieve this, Brown needs a way of measuring the motion of these stars in three-dimensional space. His proposal to use the Hubble Space Telescope for this purpose has just been approved, so it now appears that Warren Brown's life in the fast lane is about to enter a new phase. So what has that been like for you to kind of be on the trail of these objects?
Oh, it's been very exciting. It's gratifying, too, to feel like that I've fulfilled my role as a scientist by making, you know, some large discovery that it's interesting to discover these objects. It's sort of this new class of objects that tells you something about, you know, the galactic center, the supermassive black hole. We can make measurements now of those objects in ways we never could before. So that's very exciting and gratifying personally to know that I've been involved in that. And it's fun to see how this progressed. So other people have picked up on this as well. There's certainly a number of theoretical papers that have been written discussing what you can do with these objects. You know, how you can use them as tools to make different sorts of measurements. Other observers have been now looking for more high-velocity stars. So it's been sort of very fun to see how this progresses as well.
Warren Brown is a postdoctoral research fellow at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can find out more about his discovery of hypervelocity stars in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine. But get your copy soon, they're going fast.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
There are a lot of strange things going on in the human brain, but few are as well known yet as difficult to pin down as déjà vu. It's that strange sensation you get when something you experience for the first time seems to trigger the feeling of having experienced it before. Scientists are keen to understand this odd effect because of what it might tell us about attention and memory. but it's not an easy thing to study. This week, some intriguing progress in deja vu research was unveiled by Akira O'Connor. He's a doctoral student of cognitive neuropsychology at the University of Leeds, and he's developed an experiment that allows him to replicate the sensation of deja vu with subjects in the lab. We reached him in Sydney, Australia.
Hello, Mr. O'Connor.
Hello.
Hello. So, Mr. O'Connor, most people can relate to deja vu. We've all had experience of it before. But is there any scientific consensus on what deja vu actually is and what's happening?
Well, a number of studies have been carried out on the field using various converging methodologies and settled really on a theory that is the... It's the activation of a particular circuitry in the temporal lobes which gives rise to this sensation of familiarity. So normally this circuit is triggered when we encounter something that should be familiar, such as a person that we encounter from day to day, or a situation, an object that is very familiar to us, like say our own computer screen or something like that. Very occasionally, this circuit seems to misfire, and it seems to go off when we're encountering something that we haven't encountered before. So people typically report very striking deja vu experiences, say for being in a city they've never been in before.
So trying to study this phenomenon is obviously quite difficult because you never really know when deja vu is going to strike. It's one of those unexpected things that just comes up and gets you. So you seem to have found a way around this. So how did you find a way to trigger deja vu on demand in the lab?
Well, that's right. It's a nightmare to study because it is such an infrequent experience. So what we did was we hypnotized a number of participants and gave them a suggestion of familiarity for words that they would later see. So then we took them out of the hypnosis and presented them with these words which they hadn't encountered before, and it was hoped that these participants would feel a strange sensation of familiarity which they wouldn't be able to attribute to anything because we'd given them an amnesia suggestion for the suggestions themselves. And that has been relatively successful in inducing deja vu, this experimental induction of deja vu, in a number of our participants.
So you had this hypnosis methodology happening in the lab, and what did your subject actually tell you about how they felt when you got to the second part of the experiment where you'd fooled them into potentially getting deja vu?
Of our 18 participants, 10 reported that they felt a peculiar sensation, that something about their overall experience didn't feel exactly right. And of those 10 participants, 5 of them reported that what they were feeling felt like deja vu, that they didn't have any memory for the words that they'd encountered, but they felt very familiar. And that's exactly what we were looking for as far as this simulation of deja vu in the lab.
So obviously you got the results that you were looking for, at least in part in this experiment, but how has this changed the study of deja vu? What does it tell us that allows us to move on in this kind of area of research?
Well, there are various models of deja vu that it is possible to, to explain it from. And we've been working to what is a memory model. So what it does is it just provides converging evidence for the for various other studies that have found this particular piece of important circuitry responsible for familiarity, because it shows that this potentially vital part of the brain is dissociable, is experimentally dissociable from other key parts of the brain that we use in remembering. So by isolating this, by activating familiarity sensations only, rather than activating them in conjunction with an actual memory trace, we've been able to to show that experimentally you can separate the two.
So déjà vu is obviously part of a much bigger subject, which is the study of memory. So what do these results tell us about the way that memory works?
Well, I suppose they tell us that the overall experience of memory, the sensation of familiarity, and the ability to recall a memory trace to consciousness aren't necessarily one and the same thing. So as well as having a memory trace, which may be spread throughout various neurons in the brain, we also have a particular area of the brain, we believe, that is responsible for the subjective sensation, the sensation that tells us that we are in the process of remembering something. It's probably an attentional system that has been adapted in order to signal to our consciousness that we're in the process of remembering.
Fantastic. Well, Akira O'Connor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Akira O'Connor spoke to us from the 4th International Conference on Memory in Sydney, Australia, where he presented his work on déjà vu. And you can experience this story in a familiar yet different way by picking up the latest edition of New Scientist. Now here's Caroline with this week's research news.
Radiation is not only bad for your DNA, it's bad for your bones too. Researchers at Clemson University in South Carolina found that exposing mice to radiation caused their bones to become hollow and frail. The mice lost as much as 39% of their bone mass after receiving a radiation dose comparable to what cancer patients receive in a single session of radiation therapy. There's an important difference, however. In the case of cancer patients, that radiation is concentrated in a relatively small area. In the past, doctors have observed that cancer patients often have weaker bones, but since cancer itself can cause bone loss, it's been unclear whether radiation is to blame. The new finding shows that radiation alone can wither bones. It also suggests that bone loss due to radiation is a hazard that astronauts could face during a long-duration space flight, such as a mission to Mars. But in that case, it would still be a lesser concern compared to the other effects of hard radiation on the human body. Sometimes the scariest thing about surgery is not what the doctor takes out, but what he leaves behind. Statistics indicate that sponges, clamps, and other surgical tools are mistakenly left inside patients' bodies about once in every 10,000 operations. Now researchers at Stanford University in California may have a solution. Their idea is to attach a radio frequency ID tag to each surgical tool. The tags are miniature versions of the kind used to prevent shoplifting in department stores. By waving a wand-like detector over the patient's body, a surgeon can locate tools in hard-to-find areas before sewing a patient up. In a recent experiment, doctors using this sensor could find lost tools in about 3 seconds, with no false alarms. The researchers say the main challenge now is figuring out how to integrate the device into the routine workflow of an operating room. And finally, if you've ever thought you were stupid to sleep with someone, consider this. Sharing your bed could actually make you more stupid, if you're a man, at least temporarily. Scientists at the University of Vienna made this discovery while studying the sleeping patterns of 8 unmarried couples. Each couple slept together for 10 nights, and then slept alone for 10 more. The study found that even without sex, bed sharing disturbed sleep quality for both men and women. But for the men, this degraded sleep led to an increase in stress hormones and reduced mental performance the next day. In contrast, the women in the study did not have as much of a problem with stress or with mental performance on waking. Ironically, it was the men who thought they slept better with a partner, while the women had no such illusions. The findings were presented last week at the Forum of European Neuroscience in Vienna.
We hope you're enjoying this week's episode of SciPod, and we want to know what you think of our program. We also want to say thanks for all the responses we've been getting to some of our stories lately, and we can see that you've really been enjoying our last word science questions with Mick O'Hare. Mick will be back next week. Meanwhile, if you've got a comment or question about anything you hear on SciPod, please drop us a line. It's easy. Just send your message to podcast@newscientist.com. And thanks again for listening.
This week, an unusual conference is underway in Philadelphia, a conference all about alchemy. Now, you might be wondering why anyone would bother with alchemy these days. After all, with the birth of modern science, all that mumbo-jumbo about turning lead into gold was relegated to the dustbin of history. But the connection between science and alchemy is closer than you might think, and it's the subject of some fascinating research. Robert Hicks is an expert in the history of chemistry and metallurgy, and he's one of the presenters at this week's conference.
Hi, Dr. Hicks. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And Dr. Hicks, how are Philadelphians coping with this alchemy invasion that you and your colleagues are perpetrating this week?
Well, we have thousands of people demonstrating in the streets today, and the mayor has rushed down with a police cordon to keep the crowds away. No, I wish. Actually, we're doing quite well. This conference has been a real benchmark since the last conference was approximately 20 years ago, and it's really a measure of how far in the interim this subject, the history of early chemistry and alchemy, has gone.
That's interesting. I think a lot of our listeners might be surprised that this is such an active area of research. Do you think the role that alchemists played in the birth of modern science is misunderstood?
Yes, I think that's true. And in fact, some of the presentations at this conference will talk about some of the great and mighty names in the history of science and their participation in the alchemical world. Isaac Newton, of course, comes to mind immediately. But it wasn't so long ago that most narratives of the history of science talked in very triumphal terms, that all science was a march towards the creation of the present, and we are, of course, the pinnacle of scientific perfection, and we know all these great things. And chemistry has always been in the margins from my point of view. Physics and astronomy get the top billing in the history of science, and chemistry worked much differently. But chemistry, unlike the other pursuits, has always been very characterized by hands-on manipulation, working in the trenches, experimenting. And this is much a hallmark of early alchemical work as it is of modern scientific, well, particularly chemical work today.
So there's a tradition there of working with the materials that would later become the stuff of science. But how internally consistent was it? You know, was there more systematic thinking in alchemy than we might realize by looking back from such a distance?
Yes, you've raised a good question. There was a great deal of systematic thinking, but unlike today where we draw strict distinctions between, say, inorganic, organic, living and non-living, in the 17th century these lines were not at all clear. The alchemist was not, say, transmuting a frog into a person, but simply applying intelligent work in the laboratory setting in order to complete what nature started. If a rock is left alone long enough, according to Aristotle, it will naturally seek its ideal state, which would be the highest rock available, gold. An alchemist is hastening what nature would otherwise do over a very long period of time. So the search for transmuting lead into gold, to our eyes, might be irrational. 300 years ago, it made sense.
Interesting. So in a sense, blazing a trail intellectually for how to deal with the natural world.
Yes, alchemists were indeed blazing an intellectual trail, and those people that we consider the great names in early chemistry, most of whom kick in about the 17th century, late 17th, early 18th, the Robert Boyles of the world, Antoine Lavoisier, all these people depended very, very heavily on the intellectual contribution of their forebears.
Well, now, in speaking of those forebears, I know there's a special session dedicated to Paracelsus at this conference, for example. Could you fill us in about who Paracelsus is and why he would be the subject of particular interest at a gathering like this?
Paracelsus is one of those strange figures about whom a lot has been said, but it's very difficult to find out how much he himself said or did. Paracelsus is usually credited for bringing in heavy chemistry in particularly medicine, where we see back in the 16th and 17th centuries Paracelsian physicians, those who wanted to prescribe chemical remedies as opposed to what were called the Galenic physicians or chemists who hearkened unto ideas of Galen, which involved very different ideas about, for example, how to make use of mineral or animal or vegetable products for medical treatments. There was this idea, for example, of signatures, where if a rose is red, then you want to apply it to something where the red color is appropriate to the treatment, as if somehow the red color is an emblem of its healing powers. The Paracelsian would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Probably some good old-fashioned chemical recipe that I could cook up might be the best remedy for this. That's a real simplification of it, but it shows you that lines were drawn very quickly, and it's hard to find the real Paracelsus behind this, but his influence continues to be cited by people and was cited even immediately after his lifetime as representing some benchmark in ideas and practice.
So clearly a pivotal character that actually personifies what you're talking about. Now, you're also making a presentation this week, and it involves not so much old Europe as it does the exploration of the New World. What does the history of the United States have to do with the history of alchemy?
It turns out a great deal. Next year will be the 400th anniversary of the founding of English-speaking America at Jamestown, Virginia. And there will be a lot of national celebration of this fact. But over the last several years, there has been ongoing archaeology at Jamestown Island, which has recovered the original fort built by Captain John Smith and those original colonists. And the archaeology is revealing a fascinating picture. It is revealing a picture not so much of a bunch of ill-prepared English coming to the New World and suffering and fighting with the Indians, but people who actually plan this expedition very well and try to inform it with, quote-unquote, the best science available. And the people that they're bringing in and the texts these people are using as their authorities on metals and the recovery of metals from ores are alchemists. These people are part and parcel of the whole intellectual world of alchemy at the time.
That's amazing. It sounds like there's really an interesting, almost underground history here that's not widely known outside academic circles. I think you probably have many more stories you could tell us, Dr. Hicks, but I think we should let you get back to the conference. Thanks very much for making some time to speak with us about it.
I very much appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Robert Hicks is a director with the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Philadelphia, which sponsored this week's conference on alchemy. And if you find yourself in Philadelphia this weekend, you can even hear his presentation the old-fashioned way. And that's it for this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the July the 22nd issue of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, the teen gene. Scientists identify the protein that controls puberty. Now the question is whether it should be used to create a drug for parents wanting to delay their children's sexual maturity.
Unnatural selection. Computer viruses spread like wildfire on the internet because most desktop computers run the same operating systems. So why not take a page out of Darwin's book and program some diversity into our software?
And look before you dig. How physics is changing archaeology by allowing field researchers to picture the subterranean worlds they're about to unearth.
This edition of SciPod was brought to you by the staff and contributors of New Scientist magazine and NewScientist.com, which this week included Patrick Berry, Claire Bowles, Linda Geddes, Rowan Hooper, Valerie Jameson, and Maggie McKee. Our technical production is by Bill Oxley, and our theme music was created and performed by the Damn Neighbors.
Joel McFarlane is the executive producer of SciPod. I'm Caroline Williams.
And I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.